These teenagers were actually placed into the hands of traffickers by the federal government.
How the 2014 story of eight children smuggled from Guatemala to slave-like conditions in Ohio revealed gaps in how the United States takes care of unaccompanied minors.
It seems like there's still just huge problems at this little agency with horrible consequences.
4 years later, the government still loses track of children who cross the border alone. Also to date, so-called fake news laws popping up around the globe. And a survivor of the Rwandan genocide tells her story.
We did not sweep our history under, rug. It's there. You see it everywhere. So there's no guilt. It's like, this is what we've done to each other.
This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, May 2nd, 2018.
Hey, podcast people, it's Tanzina Vega. I'm going to be hosting this podcast starting next week, and I'm so excited that you're along for the ride. Remember, tell all of your friends to subscribe to this podcast now, and they'll get a daily dose of news, analysis, and views that you won't hear on every other news podcast. I mean real people like you. If you like it, rate it and review us on iTunes, and keep letting us know what you think. I'll see you soon on The Takeaway.
Marion, Ohio is a city of about 35,000 people, an hour north of Columbus. In 2014, eight teenagers from Guatemala found themselves trapped in Marion in a trafficking ring.
In the case of these eight boys, their parents paid smugglers to take them to the U.S., thinking they would be educated and cared for here.
That's Deirdre Shesgreen, a reporter for USA Today.
And a man in Ohio submitted paperwork saying he was a relative of one of the boys, and then he submitted paperwork for another and another. And the refugee office did no real verification of the relationship between these Guatemalan children and this Ohio sponsor.
The Office of Refugee Resettlement, otherwise known as ORR, is a division of Health and Human Services that resettles unaccompanied migrant children. And that office gave approval for these children to be released in Marion, Ohio.
And that agency is supposed to place them with a relative or another caregiver who will make sure they get to their court dates and make sure they're taken care of while they're waiting for their claims of asylum to be adjudicated.
Instead, the man the government approved to take custody of the teenagers was a smuggler.
These teenagers were actually placed into the hands of traffickers by the federal government. They were required to work long hours, cleaning chicken coops, debeaking chickens, vaccinating chickens. They lived in very poor conditions. One of the trailers didn't even have heat or hot water. Their pay was mostly docked to repay the debts that their parents had paid to these smugglers. It was slavery.
The scandal led to an investigation by a Senate Homeland Security Subcommittee and demands for answers from lawmakers like Ohio Republican Senator Rob Portman.
How could this have happened in America? How did HHS hand over a group of children to human traffickers? Perhaps the most troubling unanswered question is this: how many other cases are there like the Marion trafficking case? The answer is HHS doesn't know. The department maintains no regular means of tracking even known cases of trafficking or abuse, and it does little to monitor the status or well-being of the tens of thousands of children it has placed.
That was in early 2016. President Obama was still in office. And what the scandal revealed is that even in cases where trafficking isn't at play, the government does a poor job of looking out for children's welfare after they cross the border. In 2017, under President Trump, the Office of Refugee Resettlement placed more than 42,000 unaccompanied children, or UACs, and the government still continues to lose track of those kids at an alarming rate.
Between October and December last year, ORR tried to reach 7,635 of these children. Of those, ORR was unable to determine with certainty the whereabouts of 1,475 UAC. In other words, that's almost 1,500 kids missing in just a three-month period.
Today, we try to find out, how did nearly 1,500 migrant children taken into custody by the United States government disappear from the government's radar? I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway. To understand the system, let's start back in Marion, Ohio in 2014 with Deirdre Shesgreen.
The agency is supposed to have safeguards to make sure the children are placed with an appropriate caregiver. So, for example, they're supposed to interview prospective sponsors and conduct background checks on them. But that did not happen in this case. It was definitely a failure here, a failure that resulted in essentially slavery.
And how long were these teenagers in this condition working in this chicken farm? How did they eventually get free?
Well, one of the children managed to get to a phone. He called his uncle and pleaded for help. And the uncle called police. And in December 2014, about 100 law enforcement authorities swooped down on this trailer park in Marion, Ohio, and found the boys living in these cramped, dirty quarters and freed them and uncovered this trafficking ring and this forced labor.
So in the years since, Deirdre, what's been the fallout from this case in Marion? What have been the repercussions, not only for the Office of Refugee Resettlement and HHS, but for this entire vetting system?
So it's resulted in congressional hearings, and a Senate subcommittee opened a six-month investigation. That probe concluded that HHS did not conduct thorough background checks, did not verify sponsors' supposed relationships with children, and didn't take other steps to ensure that these kids were being placed in safe environments.
Now, what did HHS officials say about how this was allowed to happen and about their own systems for vetting?
So there was a hearing in 2016 before this Senate subcommittee, and I've covered a lot of hearings. I've never quite seen something like this. Their answers were honestly kind of astounding. It was, I can't tell you. I'll check with the lawyers. We'll get back to you. I've never heard quite so many passing the buck responses.
So you have no intention of ever trying to solve the problem of, here we gave the kid to the guy who said he was her uncle. And now we told the state maybe, or we didn't tell the state, and good luck to that 15-year-old who went to her uncle.
I don't agree with your characterization of the decision-making process. However, this is an expensive program. Our duty is to execute the will of Congress and the president, which we will do faithfully. If you tell
I think our duty is a little more humanitarian than that.
Well, Deirdre, there's a little bit of sound from those hearings that you were talking about. There have been hearings recently as well on Capitol Hill in the Senate. What did they reveal?
Right. So last week, there was a follow-up hearing before this same committee, and they concluded really that HHS officials still don't keep good track of child immigrants who enter the country alone and are placed in these communities around the country. The agency tried to call about 7,600 immigrant children and their sponsors between October and December of 2017, but they couldn't determine the whereabouts of nearly 20% of them. One HHS official at the hearing admitted the agency didn't have any way of tracking the kids down once they go missing. He said the agency doesn't follow up to make sure they go to their court hearings. And he acknowledged that while sponsors sign agreements saying they'll make sure the children and their care go to court hearings, the agency has no way of enforcing that. He did defend HHS and said that it plans to require fingerprint checks for all sponsors soon, not just for the non-parent sponsors. He said that they also require criminal background checks, sex offender checks, and child abuse and negligent registry checks before placing a child with a potential sponsor. But it seems like there are still some pretty gaping holes in the system.
Deirdre Shesgreen covers Congress for USA Today. Deirdre, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's try and get a broader view now of how so many immigrant children have gone unaccounted for by the Department of Health and Human Services and how people are trying to improve that agency. Allison Hurry is an immigration lawyer with Catholic Charities of Southwestern Ohio, which works with unaccompanied children, and she joins me now. Allison, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Allison, how is this process supposed to work, vetting guardians of minors who cross the border unaccompanied?
Well, when the minor is apprehended by the Department of Homeland Security at the border, they're required to submit the child to the Office of Refugee Resettlement within 72 hours of determining that the child is a UAC or an unaccompanied immigrant child. And then ORR is tasked with actually finding a sponsor in the U.S. or finding placement for the child while they're undergoing their immigration proceedings. The sponsors are usually parents. Sometimes they're extended family, like adult siblings or aunts and uncles. And in lots of instances as well, there are children who are placed with non-relatives who maybe knew the family from back home or, you know someone from the family from back home. The post-release services include helping a child get enrolled in school, making sure that they're attending their court hearings, and about 32% of UAC's total get those post-release services.
Well, Allison, we just heard that there were nearly 1,500 migrant children that HHS can't locate just in the last 3 months. Did it surprise you that there were 1,500 kids the government couldn't account for? Or is that normal?
It did surprise me in that I would have expected the number to be higher. Generally, ORR does not do follow-up calls. I think in preparation for the hearing, they decided to do these follow-up calls with the families that they had recently released children to. And in our experience at Catholic Charities, a lot of the children aren't aware of the process, and the families are scared of the process because they're interacting with the government, and that's something that's, it's something you don't do if you're in the immigrant community right now.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that because the experience of the 8 children from Guatemala in Marion, Ohio in 2014 points up a horrific experience with child trafficking, with human trafficking. But in this case, it seems like a charitable explanation for the government is that a lot of these children and their guardians may not be trying to be found.
Well, and that might be the case, but if a child is represented by counsel in immigration proceedings and attends their immigration proceedings, the child is infinitely more likely to get a benefit and relief from removal and be able to stay in the United States and be protected from the danger that they faced when they were in their home country. So, you know, one of the things that the ORR agency is required to do is make sure that these children are attending their immigration proceedings. So a lot of these children are, you know, unaware of their rights and their responsibilities because they are not represented by counsel. They're not explained the process when they're in custody. And once they're released to a sponsor, no explanation is provided to the sponsor about their rights and responsibilities and the child's responsibility to attend their immigration proceedings.
Allison, how important was the 2014 experience in Marion, Ohio, to this entire area of child resettlement? Did it rock the field? Is it something that continues to have repercussions today in how you all do business?
Well, I think for Catholic Charities, it does resonate with us because it does hit so close to home. It's only about a 2.5-3 hour drive from Cincinnati to Marion, Ohio. And we, you know, our caseworkers are going out to communities that are rural areas and doing home studies of families from all over our geographic area. So it's not just Cincinnati that's that we're covering. And I think in terms of the wider conversation, this hasn't really been something that's been at the forefront of the conversation as of yet. I think, you know, all of the investigation from the Senate committee has really brought to light the problems and the challenges that ORR is facing in dealing with and taking care of these children. Hopefully that will come to some sort of beneficial resolution for the way that we handle UACs in our country.
Well, as somebody who works with these cases every day, Allison, where do you think improvement needs to happen? What do you think the government could do next week, next month, or the next time they have an appropriations bill to improve this situation?
Well, one of the things that I think is really telling about this process is that only 32% of children get post-release services, meaning that only 32% of them are actually indicated or identified by the government to social service agencies like ours to provide services. Now, that's not to say that our agency would only provide services to individuals who are identified to us by ORR, because we do have caseworkers that work with other families that have UACs in their custody that are not in the post-release service run through ORR. But that's a big piece of it, is getting that actual service and identifying to the families the ability to access social services like ours.
Allison Hari, immigration lawyer with Catholic Charities of Southwestern Ohio. Allison, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter. They'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. All right, now back to the show.
We go now to Malaysia, where a Danish man has become the first person convicted under Malaysia's new fake news law. It's a law criminalizing the creation or sharing of content deemed fake news by the government. Salah Salim Saleh Sulaiman was sentenced to a month in jail for posting a misleading YouTube video involving the police. Now, elections are just a few days away in Malaysia, and opponents say this new law could be a weapon for censorship and silencing dissent. Mark Ludes is a journalist and editor. He joined me from Kuala Lumpur.
There was a murder in KL where the victim was a Palestinian, and he was shot dead in the streets of Kuala Lumpur. And Salah was allegedly a friend of the victim, and he was allegedly with the victim when it happened. And the entire issue arose when Salah created a YouTube video claiming that the police took about 50 minutes to arrive at the scene, and claiming that it took over 40 phone calls by the time the police arrived at the scene. And the police then responded saying that according to their logs, according to their records, they arrived at the scene within 8 minutes of getting the first call. And as a result, Salah was charged under the Anti-Fake News Act, and he was sentenced to 1 week in prison and a 10,000 ringgit fine, which is roughly about $2,500. Salah was then unable to afford to pay the fine, and there was therefore jailed for a further month because he couldn't pay the fine.
Now, Salah got arrested and convicted, as you say, under the new fake news law. It's interesting, though, Mark, because he made a video claiming something that the police say was false, but he's not a news organization. He's not a news reporter. He's just a private citizen who posted a video on YouTube that the government says is false, and yet that's still fake news.
That's right. And that is the entire thing about this law. This law applies to anyone and everyone. And it applies to pretty much every kind of media out there. This could apply to videos. It could apply to social media postings. It applies to print, to images, to cartoons. Most interestingly, or most worryingly, it also has extraterritorial applications, which means that the alleged offense could take place anywhere in the world. It could be committed by anybody. That person or that place doesn't have to be Malaysia or a Malaysian, as long as it pertains to Malaysia or it pertains to a Malaysian, they could be found to have committed an offense under this law. And that is why Salah, who's a Danish national of Yemeni descent, who was visiting Malaysia, was still subject to this law. He could have done the same thing, even if he was in Singapore or back in Denmark, and this law would still have been applied to him.
Now, Mark, what drove this law onto the books? Why is fake news perceived to be such a major problem in Malaysia? Why did the government respond in this way?
So, I mean, if you look at it, the reality of it is that there is a lot of fake news out there. And these things existed before 2016 when that phrase was coined. We used to call them rumors back in the day. All of this today is banded under this one term called fake news. And if you look at it, not just in Malaysia, but everywhere, you see this all over your social media posts. You see this all over your social messaging apps where things get forwarded and sent on without people checking to see if it's accurate or if it's true. But within this context, within what's happened right now, the worry from Malaysian civil society, from the legal fraternity, from opposition politicians, from regular people, is that fake news is being used much like the way Donald Trump uses it, is being used to describe news that the government of the day doesn't agree with. And as a result, it could be used to prosecute people out of political motivations. And that is the big worry, that this law could be very open to abuse.
And within that concern that the government could simply brand stories it doesn't like as fake news, within that, Mark, there's the question of just who judges what's fake. How does the government go about determining what fake news is and who they're going to arrest and whom they're going to jail?
That's one of the biggest questions that's been asked, Todd, because one of the big worries that a lot of Malaysian lawyers, in fact, the Bar Council of Malaysia itself has raised, is that the definition of fake is so vague that it could very well be what the government decides it is. So Malaysia has unfortunately had tremendous form in the past for jailing people that in any other country wouldn't go to jail. So, for example, a couple of cartoonists have been sent to jail for what is obviously or has obviously been parody and satire directed against the prime minister of the country. Yet they have been prosecuted under previous existing laws. And with this new law, with the fake news law, the worry is that things like satire, things like parody, anything that's tongue-in-cheek is also not going to be exempt from the long arm of the Malaysian government. And that's clearly a worry. And if it's being used for political reasons with political motivations, then that becomes clearly an abuse of power and abuse of the government's position.
Well, Mark, before we go, let me ask about you, a journalist living in Kuala Lumpur. You and I are talking about the fake news law, and you're describing some of the implications, some of the potential for corruption here. I wonder if you have a worry that someone in the Malaysian government or the police might think that you're trafficking in fake news.
Well, I mean, for as much as I report, I have to be extra careful these days and have to be extra sure that whatever I report is couched and phrased and termed in such a way that it cannot be attacked in any possible way. And in many ways, if you think about it, that has always been the case for the media, because you are still under laws of libel, under laws of defamation. And in Malaysia, there are further laws that also control or kind of regulate what the media can say or do. So in that sense, nothing really changes for me on a day-to-day basis. I believe that if I do practice the journalistic ethics which I have learned and which I have gained in my time as a reporter, I should hopefully be fine.
Still, Mark, you're human and so am I. You've made mistakes in your reporting. I know I have. Are you worried about what happens the next time you make an honest mistake and report something that's not necessarily totally true?
Well, with this law, you could make a mistake. And if that mistake is judged to be malicious or with ill intent, then yes, certainly it could lead to some very severe penalties for me. And if that happens, then, you know, liberty would be at stake.
Journalist and editor Mark Ludes. Mark, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Malaysia is not alone in cracking down on fake news, or threatening to. Yin-Yin Liu is a doctoral researcher with the Oxford Internet Institute at the University of Oxford in England, and she's been studying this phenomenon worldwide.
I would divide fake news legislation into three buckets based upon the target, right? So Malaysia has the most extreme target, one might argue, which could apply to anyone in the general public. And we've already seen a non-Malaysian citizen being arrested, as you just mentioned, through this legislation. And the other two categories or targets are platforms that actually distribute content, namely social media platforms. And the law in Germany passed in January of this year represents that. And of course, journalists and media organizations themselves. And that's represented by the law passed in India that was subsequently overturned after opposition from human rights campaigners and the media itself. So I would say that Malaysia and India and Germany represent the three major categories of laws against fake news.
All right, let's start in Germany then. Explain what they're doing there.
So I think Germany represents one of the first explicit and major anti-fake news laws. It's called the Network Enforcement Act, implemented, I think, the very first of January. And what they're doing is they want social media platforms and websites to immediately remove fake news, especially those that incite hatred, and immediately means within 24 hours of the content being labeled by a user or by the government as being fake or illegal, as they say. It's a bit of a fuzzy definition, and the fine is up to 50 million euros. There are other countries that are looking at not passing legislation, but rather implementing government task forces to investigate fake news. And the UK is a notable player there, Indonesia and the Czech Republic.
Now, Prime Minister Theresa May in the UK, as you just mentioned, has talked about forming a fake news task force. A lot of this comes out of the experience of the Brexit campaign. What's going on in the UK?
So the big player here, as everyone knows, is Russia. And I think that has inspired Theresa May's statement about this National Security Communications Unit. That also applies, by the way, to France. And I think the common kind of aim here does seem to be political. And it seems that the motivation isn't necessarily to protect ordinary users from harm, but rather politicians from opposition. And the opposition, of course, can come from both domestic and notably international forces, namely Russia.
Now, Yin, talk a little bit more about the risk as you see it in these new laws that are cropping up. Malaysia, task forces in Czech Republic, the UK and elsewhere. Designed not to protect users in your view, but to protect those in power.
I would say the biggest risk is the chilling effect, right? So it's the fact that people, journalists and ordinary users who use social media to broadcast their opinions and findings might choose not to report something that might potentially be construed as fake news, even if it's true. And this is why I also hate the term fake news. We have legislation in place for hate speech, for illegal content in many countries. What this fake news legislation seems to be doing is it's kind of blurring the boundaries between definitely illegal content that's already being covered with this new category of content that might be offensive to governments. And so, again, the biggest risk here is that there will be severe disincentives for journalists and citizens to publish anything that could potentially be controversial. And so it's disempowering the users and empowering people who are already in power.
Yin, thank you for joining us.
No problem.
Yin-Yin Liu is a doctoral researcher with the Oxford Internet Institute at the University of Oxford. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway. Thanks for being with us today. Clementine Wamaria was just 6 years old, living in Rwanda in 1994, when her world started to crumble. Neighbors began disappearing, her parents became frantic, and they sent Clementine and her 15-year-old sister to stay with their grandparents out in the country. Then, one day, the grandparents told them to run. The sisters ran out the back door and kept running, escaping the genocide that killed an estimated 800,000 people. At age 12, Clementine and her sister Claire were granted asylum in the United States. Now, decades later, she has a new memoir recounting her escape from war and a new life in America.
The only road to equality, a sense of common humanity, peace, is sharing. My mother's orange. When we share, you are not using your privilege to get me to line up behind you. When we share, you are not insisting on being my savior. Claire and I always looked for the sharers. The people who just said, I have sugar, I have water. Let's share water. Let's not make charity about it.
That's Clementine Wamaria reading from her new memoir, The Girl Who Smiled Beads, A Story of War and What Comes After. We sat down to talk about her experience and what it means when we talk about refugees.
It's very important when we are speaking about people who are seeking refuge to say it that way. An individual seeking refuge, a family seeking refuge, a community seeking refuge, rather than the word refugee, because the word refugee does not give us that human who is in need of safety. And so when we are thinking about people seeking refuge, it's so important to speak to those who are here in the United States, like me and my sister Claire, so we could tell you what we were fleeing, how we were fleeing, and what we lost, and the kindness that we've gained.
You know, when you and your sister fled Rwanda, you write about how you basically hopscotched from country to country, family to family, no normalcy, no consistency in your life.
Yes.
those types of experiences for children can sometimes prevent them as adults from really ever being able to experience or feel a settling or a calmness in their life. And I know I'm asking you a personal question, but I wonder if that's happened to you or if you've managed to get beyond that experience of your formative years.
You know, when I finished writing the book, I said to myself also, I am in a garden. I'm not in my fear or my pain anymore. I have always been this person before the war broke everything and took away so much. And again, I would say that the most precious gift I can offer to myself is to quieten the chaos in which occurred in my life in order to really allow everyone all over the world, whichever chaos, whichever internal war and external war that has happened to them, to pause and say, I am alive, I am breathing, I'm this beautiful, incredible, one and only human being. And that's really what I love to offer to people, is that freedom.
Well, you write in detail about your relationship with your older sister, Claire, how you fled together, grew up together, essentially on the run during a part of your childhood. Can you tell me about your relationship with her now and how you think the experience that you shared helped form that relationship?
Yes, Claire is Claire. actually, her name is, her second name is Mukundene, which means how may I love her. And her love for our humanity and for herself, it's incredibly unshakable. And right now, she has this incredible organization. It's called United Women. Right now, United Women of Illinois. But she's going to expand all over the world because that's always she always did. She always imagined human, solid, taking care of themselves and taking care of the world and making sure none of their children are hated and they are shunned and they are put into wars. And so our relationship is very intense because we have such a deep love for each other, because we've kept each other safe in a place where we were not supposed to survive.
So Clementine, now so many years later, you're a citizen of the United States. I'm sure that you're a voter. You know, this country still struggles in its own way with its collective memory of the genocide in Rwanda, not in the same way that you do because it's personal, but President Bill Clinton said at one point after his presidency that not intervening in Rwanda was the great mistake of his term as president. Samantha Power, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, based her entire worldview on a form of interventionalism that says we should have intervened in Rwanda, but of course didn't. And those regrets still echo through American foreign policy. Have you thought about that as you've taken up the mantle of a U.S. citizen here in this country?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's my birthright to know who is not, you know, respected. Their humanity is not respected. You know, it's my human duty. It's every human's duty to know whose life is not respected and not welcomed. And so for the past few years of my work with the Holocaust Memorial Museum, I've done all I can to be able to be a part of many people educating the incidents and the beginning of what causes such atrocity. And that is the lack of awareness, first of self and also what's happening around, and also fear, this fear that someone doesn't even have a language to. So for me, when I think about Rwanda and when I think about what happened in 1994, I think not in what should have happened, but what now we can do, right? Rwanda, go visit Rwanda. Go and see people and how they're living their daily lives. People who, you know, we did not sweep our history under, you know, rug. It's there. You see it everywhere. So there's no guilt. There's no, it's like, this is what we've done to each other. And guess what? We're living right next to each other. And what we do now moving forward, that's what matters. And so Rwanda, we are moving forward. We're going to take care of ourselves. We're never going to do that again to each other. And that is a conversation with all my Rwandan friends. That's a conversation with my mom, with my sister. We are taking care of our human. We know it. In that kind of chaos, we need to remember to take care of each other.
Clementine Wamaria, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being here.
Clementine Wamaria is author of The Girl Who Smiled Beads, A Story of War and What Comes After. That's our show for today. You can always comment on our Facebook page and be a part of the conversation here on The Takeaway. You can find me on Twitter at Todd Zwillick. You can always tweet us, of course, at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for being with us. I am Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.